Welcome back to Death by Champagne, the podcast here to keep you up at night. We have a really fun episode for you guys this week. As part of a continuation of our recent book series, we had the opportunity to interview author of 18 Tiny Deaths, Bruce Goldfarb, discussing everything from his unexpected responsibility to handle and care for the Nutshells to his process of writing this biography about Francis Glessner Lee. Hope you enjoy. This episode contains foul language, discussions about murder, autopsies, and cool discoveries. We'll do our best to stay on track, but the bottles are popped. Hi guys, welcome back.
Death by Champagne here.
We are back for the final episode, possibly final episode. We might have more lined up, you never know, for the Savage Appetite series, in which we used two other sources, Dead Girls and 18 Tiny Deaths. And today with us, we have the author of 18 Tiny Deaths, Bruce Goldfarb.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for reaching out to us. I always assume when I tag authors or, like, any kind of writer on Instagram or Twitter, I'm like, they're never going to see this. They don't want to hear from us.
Well, I've noticed you on Instagram. Somebody was liking the pictures and posted some enthusiastic comment to something, but you know, sorts of things. That's always appreciated.
Yeah, I think we're finding out that we're usually wrong about that. People like to talk about the things they like enough to write a book on.
Right.
I was lucky.
So that was the first question that I had was, do you want to explain to our listeners kind of like what your job is and how you got involved in the position that you currently hold?
I'm the executive assistant to the chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland and have a variety of responsibilities. I'm the public information officer for the agency. And before then, I've been doing that since 2012. Before then, I was committing journalism. I was writing for many, many years. And, that was how I first encountered Francis Glessner Lee in a nutshell. This was years and years ago.
Was there something about the position in Maryland? Like, did that interest you because you knew about her, or was it a complete chance?
It was a real coincidence. I had visited many times. I knew some people there, but the state had built this brand new state-of-the-art, amazing, dazzling forensic medical center that opened in 2010. And in 2012, I was an editor for a hyperlocal news website that was owned by Huffington Post and America Online. And a friend arranged a tour of the new state facility, and about a group of dozen or so editors went, and it was really very cool. And my friend Mike Eagle mentioned that they had this new position, and they never had a public information officer before, and they're looking for somebody with a medical background and media experience. And it was, you know, so clearly meant for me. And the Nutshells never came up, never mentioned in any of the hiring process. Not part of the job officially at all.
Oh, wow.
Was that a fun surprise after the fact, or did you find out and then say, I can help with that?
Just the opportunity to work every day in the same building with them was enough. Just the fact that having that proximity that was just the icing on the cake. But, yeah, the guy who is the keeper of the Nutshell Secrets, Jerry D., the retired administrator, and he's the guy who was the closest that there was to a guy Jerry D was the guy that I called up when I wanted to visit the Nutshells. I know I did it at least two or three times over the years. He knew me quite well. In fact, once I got the job there, after I'd been there several years, he found an old business card of mine from like 20, 25 years ago. Jerry just basically, you know, handed the keys to me and said it was my job now to take care of him and change the light bulbs. And, he gave me the keys to the cabinets, literally. And so, it was just my nature, to collect material. And I would find it's an amazing institution and, you know, the first statewide, medical examiner system in the country. And there's, you know, a lot of historical artifacts and documents that were there. So I'd collect old photos and the original paperwork for the loan from Harvard and basically, you know, serving as an archivist or a curator of the historical material there. So it just sort of naturally fell into my ballywick.
That is incredible. I know when we were talking on Instagram, I expressed like there is no comparison for me or what I imagine other people when they experience religion or like when they go to church or have some kind of experience with a thing like a crucifix. Like the closest I think I can come to that at this point is being around historical objects or art that makes me excited. So to hear that like you just got the keys and it's like, oh, I'm in charge of this crazy awesome thing now.
I know. Yeah. It's an absolute utter privilege, and you know it just never ceases to amaze me. And have people come to me, you know, and young people, and all around the world, and artists, and people, and you know, Smithsonian folks, and they're calling me up to, you know, because they want to see these dioramas.
That's incredible. I'm sure you get to meet a lot of interesting people with that.
I have. I do. Yes.
Yeah.
Main question, the first one that was on the top of my list after letting you introduce yourself and talk about how you made it to the medical examiner's office was within all of the Francis Glessner Lee artifacts and getting to see all the documentation and the paperwork, what kind of things of Dr. George McGrath's have you seen?
Oh, when I was in Boston, they had arranged for me. They had an entire cart loaded up with file boxes and stuff. I think there was like something like 11 file boxes, and they had also. I'm trying to remember what it was contained in, but they had. I held his the little metal plate, the medallion that was on the front of his car that said medical examiner, wearing they gave me cotton gloves to wear. And I held his lantern slides from the 1919 molasses disaster. Some of these had never been published. I posted them all on Instagram, as well as his medallion. And the lantern slides from the Sacco and Vanzetti case. And I didn't really push the matter, but, you know, they have all his case files. But they claimed it was medical information is still protected and yada yada, and so I mean there may be other material up there, I'm not sure, but I saw some I handled some good stuff.
That is amazing. I read that a lot of his papers and a lot of his artifacts had been taken, like transferred from the McGrath Library into the Countway Library, and I was digging through what was online to see like all the specimens. I believe there's a partial spinal column and letter from an inmate from a famous crime. I don't know. It didn't seem like those things were available for the public to look at, but I was floored when I saw the items that were there.
To McGrath? Because there were some files. I did go through his files. I know that there was some correspondence and those sorts of things. I'm trying to remember if there was correspondence from prisoners, but they're I don't know. I don't know. I don't have a copy of it, but in any event.
I think it was the subject of the
book.
Yeah, I think one of them was something that Francis had found to keep in the library that was a poem and a letter from someone who was in prison.
That sounds familiar. That does sound familiar. Okay.
I just looked at all those pictures today and I was like, what I would give to stand in the middle of a room with the white gloves and look at all of that stuff.
Make an appointment and go sometime. They'll even give you the gloves.
Okay, we're going back to Harvard.
Done and done, yeah.
We were
add it
lucky.
To the list.
Yes, we were lucky enough barely to get to go to the Natural History Museum inside Harvard when we were in Boston and Salem 2 years ago, but they had 45 minutes till closing. And so we had our luggage with us because we were on our way to the airport. So we parked it at the front desk and we were like, we're going to sprint through this place. Please don't yell at us. So we took off as fast as we could and we were just like, show us as much as you can.
Yeah.
I did the entire, this entire book, by the way, I don't know if it's interesting or not, was done in the cloud. And the only thing I carried with me is my smartphone, and I used an app, Cam Scanner, that makes PDFs. So literally the only thing I had with me, and I was very quickly, it was just, you know, snap and snap and snap and copy page after page after page, all that I could. There was a door closing. There was a door potentially closing at Harvard. So I was in a very much in a hurry to get up to Boston, and I spent, I forget how many days in a row, it was 2 or 3 days down there all day and just copy, copy, copy. And I came back with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents.
That is amazing.
It is.
If you're ever writing another book and need someone to help dig and organize all of the pictures and files, you have an unpaid intern in one of us.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, totally. That would be incredible. I guess you kind of mentioned like being introduced to, you know, the Nutshells and Francis, but what was it that made you want to write a whole book about all of it?
The amount of misinformation that there was about her that was online and in print. And, you know, she, Susan Marks did a documentary. She's doing another documentary that I believe is supposed to be out this fall on PBS, Murder in a Nutshell. And Corinne Botts did this wonderful coffee table book of photographs, The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death. And I know of at least 2 volumes of poetry. There have been a number of, you know, series of art, fine art that's been done. At least 2 one-woman plays and just tons and tons and tons of stuff that's online, blogs and all over the place. And there are these same stories that get repeated over and over and over again, and they're just drawn from the same material. And it just became obvious. People would visit, and they would ask questions about her. I met her. I learned through my job about coroners and medical exam. I had no idea, you know, really what that was all about, which, you know, led to understanding what Frances Glessner Lee did. And meeting her family and Bill Tyre, who's the curator of the Glessner House, Chicago. And, you know, it just was really obvious that there wasn't one. You know, her story had never been told. And so that was a real gap, you know, an absence that needed to be addressed. And so Bill Tyre had been turning down people for years, years and years. People have been wanting to get their go through the material. And they held off, and, you know, just sort of an agreement that, you know, I was okay, and they allowed me to do it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm glad that that was able to be brought to the surface, because happens with any historical figure in the medical community, forensic science, whatever, people like us who just read, you know, we read the books, we read articles, and then have a show where we talk about it. It's so easy to just take what you find, and it's hard to trace the history of, like, how a book came to be or how someone's big article came to be. So yeah. I know, like, when I got your physical copy of the book, I opened the back and went straight to the index and was like, oh, yes, this is everything.
You have the UK version. You have the octopus version edition of the book.
Yes.
How did you get that and why?
We were actually looking for which version we could get the fastest. And shockingly, I think I ordered it through Blackwell, maybe. Well, I also was being picky about the cover. I saw that edition of the cover and really liked it. So yeah. It just so happened that in order to not order from Amazon, I could get that one in the same amount of time as going and picking it up in town.
This is the poster. That was from the exhibit at the Smithsonian. It's a silk screen that was done for the Smithsonian. And they gave me 2 copies of that, of the actual poster. I have one, I should put it on the wall behind me, but it's hanging upstairs and the other one's at the office. But, cause there are some subtle differences between the different editions. There's also the small print edition. There's this.
Oh my gosh.
which is one in a scale of 1 to 12, and there are actual words in the pages.
No.
Yes, you can read
That's
it under.
That's incredible! Under oh my gosh, I love that.
How perfect.
I have. There's also the yelling edition. It's all in all caps. It's for people who are hard of hearing. But there's that. In any event.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So back to the nutshells. We've established that no one sees them as up close as you. Which are some of your favorites? Do you have like a favorite scene or favorite details?
Oh, there's a bunch of great details. You know, the unpapered bedroom is pretty cool. The way it's designed, it's the only one I think that's sort of at an angle like that, where this woman is lying in a really a sort of dingy room. And some of the subtle details, the plaster, the wall has been patched, plastered, and really it's a great effect. And that's the only one that's interactive. There's a little cord you can pull on the front of it. It flips up the pillow and you can look under the pillow. The one that, I mean, there's some very clever ones, but in terms of the most impact in the smallest space would be the dark bathroom, where the woman is laying back in a bathtub with the water running on her face and her legs dangling out. And it's a very modest, there's this wooden commode in the corner and the stained glass window over the bathtub that's backlit from the outside. And, you know, the worn spots in the linoleum and the schmutz on the wall coming up from the register, from the ventilation system. It just detailed so nicely and so sad, and you just sort of get the sense of, you know, once grand home that's been broken up into a rooming. It just tells so much about it, that space, and it's only maybe 8 inches by 8 inches by, you know, 9 inches. It's a very small space, but in terms of telling so much of a story and communicating so much in those kinds of details, it's really, that's a absolutely masterful.
Yes, I actually pulled that one up on my phone. I think that one, just in terms of flicking through pictures, anytime I see that one, the barn, and the one with the fire in the back, those are the ones, like when someone brings up the nutshells to me, those are the ones that like really stick out in my head. I think the little bottles are crazy. They're so tiny.
Those are real liquor labels. So I posted them to Instagram, and there are, of course, you know, distilled spirit experts in these people. He knew exactly what brand that was and where it was produced and everything. But an interesting thing about the dark bathroom is that the students, I believe it's at University of Wisconsin Parkside, they recreated a life-size reconstruction of dark bathroom based on pictures they found online. They did screen captures of the wallpaper and printed it out, and they reproduced it, the linoleum floor. The one thing that they knew, they were pretty sure about the height of the sink. And based on the height of the sink, they deduced the dimensions of everything else. And they acquired it and they built it. It was done by the theater department. And you can look at the photo, and it's absolutely stunning. Side by side, you can't tell which one's which. It's just amazing work.
That is so impressive.
Yeah.
I would love to see that for all. I mean, it's so fun, too, to think of the scale, because when I think of a dollhouse, it's still much larger than any of the nutshells actually is. When you think of it, like a childhood dollhouse, it takes up half of a table, and these are not even.
They ended up taking it apart. I begged them to keep it. I begged them, you know, I told them if they were – their plan is to do a new diorama every semester for their students, both the forensic science and the theater department. And I said, you've got to keep these things. I don't care what it costs, but if you had life-size reproductions of the nutshell studies, people would flock from all over just to see them.
Definitely.
Oh yeah. I would absolutely go.
I'll go to Wisconsin anyway for just beer and cheese, let alone a display like that.
Absolutely.
That is amazing. I think one of my favorite things when I was reading about like all of the detail in the book about how she sourced the materials and what she got. And I think you posted maybe on Instagram or it was another article I found that there's like a book of, or like a tray of little matches and smoked cigarettes or like a little matchstick device and just the functionality of some of that stuff or having the patience and hands to put together something that little is just incredible.
Have you seen the picture of the matchsticks, how small they're carved?
I've seen a picture of them, but I haven't ever seen it with, like, a human finger or anything in context next to it.
I've got a picture of my finger next to them for comparison it happens. But it's astounding. And each little sliver, you know, has the head dipped in the red so they look like matches. And it's just amazingly painstaking. It turned one of the misconceptions, misinformation that's been out there all these years, I keep reading that those hand-rolled cigarettes contain real tobacco, which everybody assumed that they did, but that turns out that they don't. And nobody knew until Ariel O'Connor actually picked them up and looked, but there isn't actually tobacco in there. So it's just nice to be able to get things factual and correct.
Yes, we appreciate that. I love any amount of detail. Nice. Like, there was no part of this book for me that – there's no part of any book that has anything to do with forensic history that could ever be boring to me, but like you could have written that many pages about just how the pieces were made and I would have read it front to back four times.
I know. I wish I could have, but I had to tell a story.
Totally.
And really, you know, as amazing as they are, they're really almost an asterisk in what she did in her life. It was a 5-year period out of an 83-year-old life. And this is what people know her for. So, you know, my book is really aiming to, you know, get beyond that. Not that I love talking about the dioramas, but you know, she was really so much more than that, which even makes it even more amazing. It was just one of these one-off things that she did.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by that too. Like, as I was reading the book, I realized I was over halfway through it and still hadn't gotten to the nutshells. And then I kept reading about her bringing all of the police officers together for training and all the other stuff she did. And I was like, I came to the same conclusion. I was like, there is so much that no one really knows. You just see an article about here's 10 pictures of the nutshells this woman made.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Kind of on those lines, is there anything that didn't make it into the book that you wish had?
There are many things that didn't make it into the book because things have to go. I wish I could have written much, much more about the Glezners. It's an amazing family. Her brother George was just his whole story. He was a very early adopter to photography, and you know, he's an amateur photographer, but he was very accomplished. And took a lot of photos of the 1893 World's Fair. I would have loved to learn more about him. George McGrath, he's just an amazing guy. I wish I could write an entire book about him. I don't know how much material is out there. I don't know if I want to revisit it. But the Glezner family, and there were just a bunch of anecdotes that couldn't make it in. And, you know, there's some good stuff, and oh well.
It happens.
Yeah, that is the process when writing a narrative story. I think on the lines of McGrath, too, I was delighted to have that bit in the book where it reminded me so much of the books I've read on surgical history and like medical history in general. And we didn't know anything about the system of coroners and how corrupt and horrible it was and how it wasn't functional at all. After we finished, we actually just recorded, it's not even out to listeners yet, a bonus episode for the people that subscribe to our show every month. And I went even deeper than the first episode on McGrath and all the things that he accomplished and how Francis tried to keep pushing through his death to get the medical department, the Department of Legal Medicine, up and running. And we covered some of the cases that he was involved in. We have access to newspapers.com, which is real simple, typing in his name. And I spent probably 2 hours opening every tab.
You should also search, though. He's often McGrath, M-C-G-R-A-T. So you have to, when you search, you have to try variations on his name. But he was just a what a character he was. But he's quite a guy.
Yeah, we talked about the Margaret Perry Williams case that I just happened to find that through newspaper searches.
Which one was that?
A woman named Margaret Perry Williams was found dead at the bottom of a staircase in a barn, and her husband ran for help. He came home and discovered her body, and then come to find out all these months later, because of a journalist at another local newspaper in Yarmouth, they sniffed out the story and they were like, that seems suspicious. She wouldn't faint and fall down the stairs. Someone pushed her. So these journalists in the 30s tracked down their neighbors at the time and a bunch of witnesses that hadn't spoken to the police, and they ended up finding out that her husband beat her and pushed her down the stairs, and he caused her death. And McGrath got called in to do the secondary autopsy.
I don't recall encountering that one. That sounds absolutely fascinating. I thought I searched pretty well. I don't know what I missed. I don't know what I missed.
Well, I also found that one went pretty deep because I think it was a...
Bunch. I mean, we're talking about, he just did bunches and bunches of cases.
Yes.
I don't know everyone, and I didn't go deep on all the cases because, I use a couple examples, he's not really the major thrust of the book. And so, I wish I could have gone in that whole direction, but I didn't.
Yeah, I think I found that one because I was searching for another example that you gave, and then this case was also mentioned, like, after McGrath worked on this other case, he came back to this one, and I was like, okay, well, I'll search her name and see if I can find it. And I ended up finding I think the article was from 1951, that was an entire timeline of, like, 1930 to 1932 when the guy was finally arrested.
Wow.
I'll have to send you the link. It was a very well-written and interesting article.
I would really love to read it. Yeah.
Oh, well, kind of on the same note, are there any other cases that you know of, or if you're allowed to talk about it, not bearing the nutshell's secrets, are there any other true events that inspired the scenarios? Or since you wrote about them, would you like to talk about some of the inspiration for some of them?
Well, the one I went into in some pretty good depth was the Frederick Small, the murder of Florence Small. Which, I came to realize was the inspiration as I was reading, about the case, realized that was the inspiration for the burned cabin, the one that's torched in the corner. And when I got to work the next time, I don't know if it was the next day or the next after the weekend, I couldn't wait to go look at it again. And right there in the foreground was a little alarm clock there in the diorama. So I was, that sort of pretty much sealed it for me, but that was a good one. The woman in the, unpapered bedroom, Susan Marks, who did the documentaries, she did, the upcoming, Murder in a Nutshell. She had some interns, she had some people that they tracked down the origins for a lot of the cases. The guy who was, the barn, the big one where the guy's hanging from the rope inside the barn was a case that had been investigated by George Burgess McGrath. The unpapered bedroom, the woman in that, I guess it's a rooming house or basically a hotel. That was, Alan Moritz case. I'm not sure about the two car garage. Now the parsonage parlor, which is often photographed a lot, which is this unfortunate young girl who's got a knife impaled in her abdomen in the parsonage parlor. That was based on in the diorama. Her name is Dorothy. I forget her last name. But the case that is best based on is Constance Shipp. And that was it wasn't contemporaneous. That the Constance Shipp case was the historical one that was in the papers. It was like, you remember this case from whatever it was 20, 30 years ago. And it was, there was coverage of it at the time while she's working on the dioramas. But that one, there's a lot to it and you can Google it. And it's the Constance Shipp with two P's. And, that was the inspiration for that one. I'm not so sure. And I have to think about the others. but they were, you know, loosely based on actual cases. They're inspired by actual cases, but she changed a lot of superficial details. And they're really just, you know, deliberately incomplete exemplars for the purposes of observing.
How long were her dioramas, like, used for educational purposes?
They're still used for education.
Still used? Oh, wow.
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
We do the... They do something that isn't done any way else.
Yeah.
It's there is no VR or anything. There's no substitute for a three-dimensional object. But the seminar that she established in 1945 is now held annually at the OCME where I work, and it's still done the same way with the same traditions, and they still get the diploma, and they still go out for a fancy dinner, and they still observe an autopsy, and they still observe the nutshells, just as they always have.
That is amazing.
That is, yeah.
It really makes you think about when you mentioned the life-size version that the university in Wisconsin put together, like,
yeah,
if the how cool that would be. I mean, it's cool at that scale, but then to also be able to, it seems like there's...
Like walk in the room.
Yeah.
Be life-size with it.
It's a real bonding experience. These guys, they come back years later. If they visit, they're coming back from town and they want to see their diorama, but they remember it and they remember all the details of it. And it really is something that, and it's a big part of the homicide seminar too.
I assumed that I was correct. My father was a homicide detective for several years and is a police chief now. And I asked, I was like, are you familiar with the nutshell studies? And he knew what they were. And I was like, you didn't go see them ever and not tell me, did you? And he was like, no, I've never seen them. But I told him as soon as we started talking about it, I was like, you got to put it on your list. You have to go.
It is so cool.
I told him I would send him the book or drop it off as soon as I could so he could read it for himself.
Did I send you, have you seen the 3D VR images of the dioramas?
Some of them, yes, I have. Olivia, you
have? No, I have not. No, no.
I can send you the links. Not the ones from the Smithsonian, the other ones.
Oh, no. I haven't seen, I've seen the Smithsonian versions.
Oh, I got something better. I will send you, the links. These things... You click the button on your smartphone and you hold it up horizontal in front of you. You can put on the goggles. It's even better, but it's immersive. It'll put you inside the diorama.
So crazy.
Oh, that's.
I will send you the links.
Definitely need to do that.
As soon as these second rounds of vaccinations happen, we're gonna get in the same room.
Yes.
I know a guy. I we'll get you in.
Fabulous. That is incredible. Outside of focusing on, like, you know, we established that Francis Glessner Lee and the nutshells and all the history about George McGrath kind of fell into your lap. Since then, or outside of that, are there other people in medical or forensic or legal history that interest you?
Well, I mean, there has not been a lot written about, American forensic pathology. I mean, there's been a lot individuals have written, you know, Noguchi and all these doctors, and they've all written their, you know, their best ofs and going over their cases. But, you know, it's just as a, in terms of reporting on the area, there hasn't been a lot done in the area. So, I don't know how much more I'm going to do. We'll see.
Was there, when you were writing 18 Tiny Deaths, as far as we talked about the information that you got to search through, was there any part of that that was, like, frustrating, or what was the most tedious piece to try to put together in order?
It was, the whole thing, when you talk about writing, there's writing and writing. I don't know how much you want to get into it, but the writing itself took place in like a 9-month period. Once I got the go ahead, and I just immediately, you know, just took off, went to Boston, and The worst part was, well, the Airbnb in Chicago was pretty dismal. I'm not sure. There may have been some forced labor going on there, and the whole thing was weird. But in any event, it wasn't frustrating. It was there was a bit of a fear. I mean, there's a lot of doubt, just real doubt, a doubt in the subject, and mostly a doubt in myself. You know, it was a lot of responsibility I had over my desk. I had pictures of Francis Glessner Lee glaring at me, and watching me. And, you know, it was constantly, because I really, you know, I had never done anything of this magnitude, the size before. And there was a real responsibility because she does have fans and she does have family that I have to be truthful. I don't want to waste people's time. I got to tell them an original story. I want to tell them things that they don't already know, but I have to satisfy people who already know her. And it, since, you know, I have to be, you know, this may be the only biography that's written about her, you know, so, and this part of history. So it is really a big responsibility to get it complete and accurate and do it right. And, you know, could I do that? I don't know. And, I knew about 2/3, 3/4. I was sure about certain things. I'd spent so much time fiddling with it and working on, the wool gathering and all the stuff, that, you know, I had a pretty good sense of the general skeleton, so to speak. But I didn't know until I really got deep into it what I would find. And there was a fear that I had signed the contract to produce a manuscript of 80,000 words. And what happens if I get to 50 or 60,000 words and I have said everything that there is to say about it? And that was that could be a problem. But as it happened, you know, I was just blown away by what was actually there. And there was so much. I didn't know how much of her voice there would be. And, you know, a book that, is totally unrelated to forensic science, but, Rebecca Skloot's, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, you know, here you have a book about a woman in which the main subject, not only is she not available, she never kept a journal. There's no correspondence. Is really pretty much the only thing that's known about the subject of the book is this one photograph, which is a really challenging, you know, so but it turned out that there's a lot of material that was in Frances Glessner Lee's voice that I've incorporated, and, you know, radio scripts where she had written biographies and this whole manuscript that she produced. And I was just totally blown away by what was actually out there. And the story emerged on its own. There was this natural, you know, an arc to it with the good guys and the bad guys and the love interest and the whole thing and the dramatic conclusion and the call to action and her own words and all of, you know, oh my God, this is, you know, all I have to do is observe it and write what actually happened. And there is the book. So that's literally what happened. So, you know, it was around, 5 months of organizing and collating and arranging all the papers. And then about 3 months and some change to do, sit actually at the keyboard and write it out.
That seems like a terrifyingly short amount of time to someone who writes 15-page podcast episodes.
Yes, but. I mean, yeah. The entire process. Can I tell you the whole ugly story?
Yes.
Before you do a book, you have to do a book proposal. You know, so a book proposal has a detailed outline and all this, and you and marketing information and comparative titles and all these things, and a sample chapter. So I worked on the book proposal. Took me around, I'd say, probably better part of over 3 years. And the problem was mainly with the sample chapter. And I wrote a sample chapter that I really, really liked. And my agent totally hated it. And I did it again, I had to do it 4 times. I rewrote the sample chapter. I wrote 30,000 words to come up with a 6,000 word sample chapter. I wrote this wonderful set piece. I really loved it so much, about the 1893 World's Fair and all the things that were going on, and H.H. Holmes and all this stuff, and, Alphonse Bertillon. I mean, all these things were converging at the World's Fair. And, you know, she's too young. It needs to be something more So it was brutal. It was brutal. And my wife said to me, I just remember the day. I was just like, you know, I don't know. I can't do this. I don't know. And my wife said, you know, have you thought about doing a flashback? It's no, it's awful. It's terrible. I can't. It's a device. It's a gimmick. Why would I do that? And then I was talking with my agent a few days later, and she said, why don't you do a flashback? You ever think about that? So it worked. You know, it ended up I had a small amount of material, and I found this letter from 1944 when she about her heart attack, and I found this correspondence. And that is absolutely perfect. It's the right time, right thing. There you go. Let's go with that. And so it worked. And so I naturally owe it all to my wife's, and you know, they were right. They were right. I was wrong. But the process itself. So during this time, I had written a chronology, and I had written those really detailed outline. And every time I encountered a new fact, I would fit it in where it fit chronologically. And I realized these things, they became apparent. I realized these relationships that I might not have otherwise, and names. I recognized names when I'd see them in the correspondence because I spent so much time reading what I could in order to get prepared. So it ended up working in my favor. So when I got to the writing, literally, you know, I knew what happened. I had the outline, and it's a matter of fitting pieces where they belong and reporting on what it was.
Yeah, I think that comes through in a lot of the places where quotes were picked to like make a point or talk about a moment. And then you have an actual thing that one of them said in the room. There were many moments where like I was trying to pick quotes out of things that you wrote, descriptions, or like to emphasize an emotion that happened. And I was like, I can't imagine what's available that I'm not aware of. But every time I would read a quote and I was just like, yes, that's what Francis Glessner Lee would say. Like that is, I felt like everything was picked to great emphasis.
I tried to, you know, I get as much of her voice, you know, and every little bit, I felt like I squeezed all the good juice out of the material as much as I could, and to distill, but to get as much of her out of it. Since
That's
the
awesome.
Book was about her.
Yes. And I will say, you can tell your editor that one person might be a tiny bit disappointed that the World's Fair intro didn't happen, that was the sample chapter. I texted Olivia when that happened, and I was like, this is what I learned about in school. I had a couple like Industrial Revolution era classes and learning about art history through that time period. And so as soon as there was mention of the World's Fair, I was like, this is my time period. I want to know everything about what happened. So the notes of like her curating an exhibit for one of the expositions was amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, the 1893 World's Fair, I thought was also important in Frances Glessner Lee's life because there was the Women's Congress and there were people staying at the home and there's all these, you know, intellectuals and a lot of kind. There must have been. She's 15 years old and this is going all on. It's the biggest thing ever right there and a lot of art too. So, of course, you know, but there's no documentation of her. I wish there was, but there wasn't much documentation of her visits to her thoughts on it, you know, which is a shame.
Yeah. That would have been very fun to read about if there was any insight into that.
Yeah.
Is there anything else? I think we've actually run through our entire list of firm questions that we had down. In hearing about your writing process and everything that it took to get through the material, I think I can say, like, as I was reading this book, I just kept texting Olivia, and I was like, hurry, read, get to this part. I focused quite a bit on McGrath in our episodes, and in this one that's going to come out at the end of the week, I was just, as soon as I finished the book, I just opened Google and was like, what else could I possibly find about this man?
Yeah, you know, in listening to what you had previously done about it, it was, you know, it struck me, first of all, I mean, it comes through, it appears to me as though you really enjoyed the book, which is very, very nice to hear. I mean, it's so thrilling, it makes me feel so good. But you really got into it, and I really liked the things that you picked up on, like McGrath and his eccentricities, and there are some other things. But, you know, you really, you know, you picked up on some things about it. And we didn't even talk about that, about the composition of the people in the dioramas and how they represent and all these things and why they're not people of color and all those things. But you really touched on some, I thought, really important points that were original and not directly from the manuscript, which, you know, that even means so much more to me that you actually were thinking about this, which is, you know, that's just awesome.
Thank you. I think that stems from my background as an only child. Books were my friends. When I had no one to talk to, I talked to myself about what I read. We haven't gotten the chance to talk to Rachel Monroe yet, but since we kind of positioned our entire series around Savage Appetites, and the last three episodes are the other subjects in her book, it was really a treat because I knew who Frances Glessner Lee was, but I'll never forget. I opened Savage Appetites while I was getting a haircut. I was like, well, this is going to take hours, so I might as well start reading the book. And the first few pages that are about Frances Glessner Lee, I was like, this is already so much more than I knew. And this is just one section of her book. So it was very fun to get, like, you know, kind of a peer perspective on it. Someone who knows the material has, you know, read it from a relatable point of view for me, and then to go back to the source material, I was like, this is all I could ever ask for, peer-reviewed material and the original book.
Rachel is such a wonderful writer, and her book is terrific. I love it.
Is there anything else about the writing process, the book, the history that...
No, you didn't ask about the job. Fine with me. We don't have to talk about that.
Didn't talk about what?
The job, the medical examiner's office.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if there's anything we need to know about that, probably not.
We don't have to talk about it. We don't need.
I do have one question that you can shoot down. Do you know any of the solutions to the nutshells?
Well, I know the solutions. You know, I've heard them, and I haven't seen the written solutions that Jerry D has, but I have attended the homicide seminar every year since 2013. I've heard an awful lot about them through that and through, the Renwick, the conservators. I think so.
That's always the fun part for me. And looking at them, I'm excited to do the VR because I look at pictures back and forth and I'm like, if I could just get closer, I'm sure I could see something that would be meaningful.
And then once you see them in person, you want to stick your head in the cabinet. You can't get close enough. There's no end to getting close enough. You just...
It's incredible too that some of them have furnished rooms or pieces that you really can't even see because you can't stick your head inside.
If you visit, I will show you some things that you cannot see from the public. I will show you the...
Oh, we are absolutely visiting.
Yes.
There's no if. It's a when.
We both just got our first COVID vaccine this weekend, so we are on a quick timeline to being semi-back to normal life.
All right. Well, yeah. I'm fully vaccinated.
Awesome. Well, I think, Olivia, unless you have anything else, that was the end of our list of questions.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you so much for hanging out with us. I was truly shocked. It happens every time that I open Instagram or Twitter and someone has actually answered me or reached out. And I was like, oh, someone wants to talk to us about this. And I sent it to Olivia and she was like, no way. And I was like, maybe after this one, we'll get used to it. And next time we'll be like, oh,
never
thank
get
you.
Used to yes. it.
Well, that's a good sign. I've listened to your podcast. Whatever encounter there is on social media, any sorts of things, but you know, you got a profile.
We will keep it up. And, if there's any word for more books on the way from you, we will be first in line.
Yeah.
There may be soon.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay.
Great.
Well, now that we are social media friends, I will keep those notifications on.
All right. I'll send you the links. Can I send them over Can I do it over Instagram? I'll send you the links.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. All right. I'll do that then.
Awesome.
All righty. Well, very nice to see you both, and thank you for having me. I've enjoyed talking about my favorite subject. And
awesome. Us too. And thank you for putting so much incredibly detailed work into it.
Oh, yeah. You're so nice. All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Boom, 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 boom